on trees, same shadows, whichever leaves, I can't let go. You plant the seeds and let them grow, but who believes?
Welcome to Bending the Arc. Bending the Arc is a show offered by the Shasta Equal Justice Coalition here on KKRN Progressive Community Radio, supported by listeners like you. And on this show, we typically focus on criminal legal reform, but in this season, we're talking to a number of different people who are working in fields of environmental justice. And so today I have the great pleasure of speaking to Timna Axel. Welcome, Timna.
Hi.
Hey. So we always start off on both this and on mindfulness, letting our conversation partner introduce themselves and whatever is important for them to say to ground the conversation.
Okay, I can start. I'm Timna Axel. I use she, her, or they pronouns. I live in Chicago with my wife, Rebecca, and I work for Earth Justice as a senior public affairs and communications strategist. I've been doing that for about 4.5 years.
For people who might not know, can you tell us a little bit about Earth Justice and, you know, kind of broadly what it does, its role in the environmental justice world?
Yes. Earth Justice was founded back in 1971. And today we're actually the largest public interest environmental law organization in the country. Mm. We have some 200 attorneys, and they work on, I think, around like 700 different legal matters. We represent our clients for free. So we take on fights that include biodiversity preservation, transitioning away from fossil fuels towards clean energy, and tackling the right to a healthy environment free of pollution. We represent clients from all 50 states and Guam and Puerto Rico and DC. And those clients include small grassroots groups and national organizations and tribes and indigenous communities too.
In the show we did in August with David Takash, who's an environmental lawyer, and he was mentioning that Earth Justice was, I think, one of the first that signed on to sue the Trump administration on changes to the Endangered Species Act that mm-hmm. just happened. Can communities come to you? I mean, is that kind of fall in the grassroots group arena?
Yeah, I think as long as there's an organization structure, a C3, for example, a community organization like that can come to us and ask for representation. But I think we don't represent individuals, and I think a looser association might be hard to show standing in front of the courts.
Sure.
But I'm not an attorney, but mm-hmm. that's my understanding.
Mm-hmm. To your knowledge, has Earth Justice ever taken on a living entity as a client? We were speaking in the last show about the move internationally to give rights to rivers or mountains and all that implies. I know that hasn't really happened here in the States, but is that something that's ever talked about?
Yeah, rights of nature is a really interesting, cutting edge, I think, part of the legal field right now. I know that there's folks at Earth Justice who are very interested in it and are watching it closely, but I don't know of any cases we're taking on where we're putting forward that argument yet.
As a large organization, you said about 200 lawyers, and how many employees overall?
I think we're close to 600 staff altogether.
Wow.
Yeah.
What are you finding are some of the common commitments that staff bring to a nonprofit organization where I'm guessing many people could be earning more money maybe elsewhere?
Yeah, I think that's true, especially when it comes to the attorneys.
Mm.
The attorneys who work for us are very, very dedicated, passionate, hardworking people. They put in intense hours, I think, similar to what you might see at a private law firm, but for a small fraction of the pay. Mm-hmm. And, you know, many of them land at Earth Justice after a long career in public service, in the government. We have people who work with us who used to work in, you know, the Obama administration, other administrations, folks who worked at the DOJ or the local, you know, the state EPA, folks who kind of have some familiarity with the government and have served in that role. And then we have folks who have come here after careers in the corporate world and I think are looking for more meaning and more fulfillment and realize that they can put their skills to something that makes a real difference. Mm-hmm. So it really crosses quite a range of experiences here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that piece of having worked in the government must be super critical to the kind of work that you're doing. When it comes to making legal cases, and who all is involved in any work related to policy proposals or recommendations?
Yeah, we have a lot of teams. So we have 15 regional teams that are doing work based on protecting places and people in those areas. So we have teams in Alaska, California, Texas, like all over the country. And then we have program teams that drive change across those borders by focusing on issues, biodiversity, clean energy, fossil fuels. We have a sustainable food and farming team. We have a toxic exposure and health team and the Tribal Partnerships Program, which I work for. Those tend to be teams of lawyers, but we also have policy and legislation experts, people who work on the Hill directly mm-hmm. with elected officials. We have a media advocacy team, which I'm a part of. And there's also an affiliated C4 organization called Earth Justice Action, does federal and state lobbying to strengthen our environmental laws.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so for people that don't know, C4 is a nonprofit designation that allows you to do more advocacy than a C3 would, right?
It allows you to take a political position to support or oppose a political party or even a candidate, mm-hmm. Which a C3 organization isn't permitted to do.
Right, right. A C3 can do positions on different policies or legislation, but not people or parties.
That's right, exactly. Right.
Yeah. So when you were talking about those teams, you would have someone who does policy, a lawyer, someone who does related to communication on each of those regional teams?
I'm going to say that's the ideal. In an ideal world, that's how it would work. And I think that's what the organization tries to get to. You know, in reality, we have a lot of work and not enough people to do all the work in front of us.
Sure. So
often, you know, it's only a couple of those folks on a team that really could use the whole slate. And there are some cases that are, we think better serve our clients to just focus on the legal work and leave the policy and the communications advocacy alone. There's some cases that actually do better a little bit underneath the radar. So it really depends on, it's a case by case basis.
How does an organization like yours manage keeping up with all of the changes that are happening? Like, how does that happen when you've got already so much work in front of you?
Yeah, it's a good question. I'll say that, first of all, a lot of these issues, even though this administration is attacking these issues in certainly new and unprecedented and very aggressive ways, mm-hmm. they're longstanding issues that we have been involved with or litigated on for sometimes like mm-hmm. decades. And every, you know, sometimes we have to dramatically change course every 4 years because the federal government changes its position depending on who's in the White House. So like one good example of this from my portfolio is the attack that's happening on the Boundary Waters, which is a really massive wilderness area in northern Minnesota. It has over 1,000 different interconnected lakes, and it's actually the most visited wilderness area in the country. And there's a Chilean mining company that wants to construct a massive mine right at the headwaters of that wilderness. And the Trump 1 administration did that company a big favor. They reinstated these old leases that had expired to try and allow them to open this mine. So we filed a lawsuit. We filed a lawsuit on behalf of three environmental groups. We actually had to do it twice. And then under the Biden administration, those leases were canceled. And the company sued the administration instead. So then we had to jump into court to defend the administration and their actions from the company. And now, under Trump, too, we're fully expecting them to go ahead and reverse those gains. And we're preparing our legal strategies for what's coming. So a lot of this is very scary, for sure, and very threatening. But it's also it's a playbook that we know. We were very active during the Trump 1 administration, and we were successful in a lot of the cases we brought. So I think that's given the organization some confidence that even though it's a lot of work and it's hard, we certainly can take them on.
Mm-hmm. That's a great example of having to switch sides and the benefit of knowing such a case so deeply. And I'm guessing that you have people, given the reputation of Earth Justice and how long you've been there, clients and communities and others alerting you of changes that are coming. Does that happen a lot?
Yeah, luckily, we've been doing this for a long time, you know, since the 70s. And so a lot of teams have deep relationships with community organizations and advocates across the country who have formed these different coalitions, you know, and networks that work on these issues, long-standing issues, things like air pollution and water pollution, things like toxics and plastics. And the overburdening of communities, the lack of cumulative impacts assessments. These are issues that, you know, have stuck around for quite a while. And so having those conversations, being in relationship with the communities that have already done a lot of groundwork and kind of have a sense of what's coming is a huge weapon in our arsenal.
I'll bet. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Bending the Arc on KKRN and my conversation with Tina Axel, Senior Communication Specialist at Earth Justice. What are some other kind of long-standing cases that Earth Justice has been involved in? You mentioned the mining one, and certainly that's been in the news too with talks of allowing mining around Chaco Canyon, for example. Are there others that the public might be more aware of?
Yeah, you know, there's lots. One particularly long one is the dam removal and salmon restoration that's underway in the Snake River. That's involved like three decades of litigation. I'm not directly involved in that project, but there are many nationwide issues that we litigate on. You folks might remember the Supreme Court ruling seven counties, which had to do with the National Environmental Protection Act. The National Environmental Policy Act, NEPA, which is a really, really important bedrock environmental law that guarantees the public some participation and some ability to give input on major projects and forces the government to consider alternatives when they're thinking about approving or funding some new highway or mine or oil pipeline so that we really know what the consequences of those actions will be. We were part of that case before the Supreme Court. And, you know, there are many others. Like I said, I think we have like 700 different active matters that we're involved in.
Currently.
Yeah, right now. It's quite a large caseload. And I only see a very narrow slice of that pie. It's pretty daunting, actually, when you think about how many different things we work on.
Yeah. If someone in the public here wanted to go in and see or to find out what Earth Justice might be involved in supporting here in like far northern California, is there a way to do that?
For sure. You can visit our website, of course, earthjustice.org. Mm-hmm. And we do have a California regional office with offices, I believe, in San Francisco. And if you go, if you navigate to their page on our website, you'll see some of the cases that they're taking on right now. We also have a really great social media team. You know, if you follow us on any of the social media platforms, you'll be sure to get updates. And we have an action center on our website where you can sign up with your phone number or your email address. And if you give us your location, we will try to send you specific actions to do with opportunities to make a difference on more local items. Maybe there's a comment period that's open on a mine or a power plant near you. We will try to make sure that you know about that, and we may be able to give you some language and a way to actually get involved in that fight.
That is great. And I will definitely put that information in the show notes so people can come back to it in case they're driving while they're listening to this. And we'll send it out to people through our social media too. And certainly it takes this whole organization of all these different teams that you were mentioning to make things happen. And I'm guessing even just on the legal team that there's a cadre of people that are helping lawyers prepare cases. Can you give us a sense of the scope of what has to be, you know, what is in place to make some of these actions happen?
Yeah, it takes a village. You know, we have some extremely well-organized and eagle-eyed litigation assistants and legal practice managers. And they're the folks who do a lot of the research on the cases, the citations that the attorneys are going to need to know as they prepare their arguments. They compile the briefs, which in some of these cases, they can run over 100 pages long. And that is a huge amount of work. The courts, you know, they vary in how they expect these arguments and briefs to be presented, and they're extremely picky about it. And we're in front of a lot of different courts, federal courts, state courts. We're in front of administrative law judges, which are part of agency procedural law. And so these professionals really have to know a whole lot, and they have to be ready quickly. Sometimes we're trying to stop drilling, for example, that could destroy a sacred site for a tribe. And we know that drilling is about to commence. We need to file for a preliminary injunction right away and hope that the court will grant that order and stop that drilling. And so our attorneys and our legal practice managers have to be really on the ball, and they have to work quickly, and they have to do it well so that we won't get dismissed out of hand. Then, you know, you have the actual attorneys who are doing a lot of meeting with the clients. They are trying to understand what exactly the clients, which again, they might be community organizations, they might be tribal nations. What is the outcome that they actually want? Do they want to stop a certain project, or do they just want to make sure that they're not completely cut out and that there is some kind of benefit for the local community if this project moves forward? So they have to strategize based on their communication with the clients. They have to prepare these briefs. Often they have to go and argue a case in a court hearing. You know, that's just one part of the case. Then you have appeals, you have the appeals of the appeals. And all of this takes a lot of time. Some of these cases that we're involved in, like I said, could be a decade or more, actually. The ones that I have seen, you know, they can, they're usually a couple of years to actually see it through from beginning to end.
Mm-hmm. Well, I can definitely see just taking on a small scale here, taking into account the amount of time and requesting information, which also entities seem to be very picky about. Like if you ask for something and you don't call it by the right name or label, you're not going to get it. It's not really like, oh, you should have called it this, or do you want this code? Or so that I'm guessing is a very intense process for those teams as well.
Right. And then there's, you know, there's the FOIA process, which the Freedom of Information Act is a really important, powerful law we have that allows us to get information from the government that is part of the public square. And you have to know how to file a FOIA and what data to ask for, and you have to ask it for it in the right way. You kind of have to know what you don't know in order to have that be fruitful. So yeah, there's all sorts of interesting twists like that that our legal team has to navigate.
Yeah. So you are a senior communication specialist. What is your domain? Like what are you covering in as part of your role?
Yeah, so I'm a senior public affairs and communication strategist is my title now. But basically, I'm a communication specialist or strategist. And what I do is I'm pretty much embedded with these attorney teams. I sit in meetings with them and with our clients, and I figure out together with them what should our message be when we talk about this particular case. And what are the media and communication strategies that will actually help advance the goal for our clients, either inside the courtroom or outside the courtroom? You know, what's going to move the needle in the public discourse on this particular issue? And then I try to execute those strategies. So I work with a social media team. Sometimes we hire influencers. We work with ad agencies to place ads. I do a lot of relationship building with journalists and pitching journalists on different stories. We work with writers who create really strong educational content. And of course, all the work with our different partners, other organizations and allies who have their own megaphones and their own platforms. And so a lot of this is really just writing and phone calls, honestly. It's talking points and press releases, campaign strategy documents, social media copy, and phone calls to reporters and clients and partners.
Yeah. What does that look like to pitch a story to a journalist? And I'm guessing it's very specific to the media outlet and maybe individual reporters that you have connections with or their beat, but how do you go into that thinking about your strategy?
Yeah, it depends a lot on your goal and your story. You know, some stories are big stories just because maybe they involve the Supreme Court, or maybe there's something kind of sexy about it, like, for example, AI and data centers are a huge topic in news. There's a lot of interest in them. Those kinds of stories, you know, are easier to pitch because you know that journalists are generally looking for stories about them. The public is interested to understand these topics. And so you could, you know, I might do a wider pitch on that and let every journalist that I know who's covering this basic beat, let them know that there's something coming up and we have information from them and we think that they should cover this story. It's always really helpful to give them a breakdown in simple terms of how we see this issue, what angle we think makes sense, and then, you know, prepare some spokespeople. In our case, it would be attorneys. Make sure that our attorneys are prepared to talk to the press and then just set them up with conversations and make sure that our side of the story and our clients and their voices are really part of the news coverage. Other stories are a lot less newsy. Maybe we're talking about a public utility commission and how, you know, it's looking at the energy grid in a certain county and thinking about shifting, you know, to gas generators, something like that. It's wonkier. It's a little, maybe it's a little more difficult to conceptualize. And if there's not some kind of a newsy hook, it's going to be harder. And so with those, I really have to think about which reporters like to cover this kind of a story. What's an angle that would specifically appeal to them and their readership? What's the right outlet? You know, if it's going to be a complicated issue, we probably need more ink to actually explain it. And so maybe we're looking at a long form outlet that tends to do more of that kind of storytelling. It's a lot of looking at the media landscape and then strategizing internally to figure out where's the right place to try and promote this story.
And do you have media outlets that are really more focused on environmental issues that you are continually feeding, or is that also selective on, you know, we really want you to run this story as opposed to, you know, here's more information because your readers are focused on biodiversity or climate change or things like that?
There's not a lot of environmental focused outlets. You know, we're lucky in this country that we have Grist. Grist is doing a phenomenal job covering the news. And up in Canada, they have the Narwhal, I believe. And so there's a couple outlets that do focus on these issues and do a very nice job. And of course, we try to, you know, make sure that we're in really good relationship with them. And we tend to share a lot of information with the folks over there. The rest of it really tends to be city or state-based regional outlets, maybe the affiliates of like a USA Today, or I'm here in Chicago, so the Chicago Tribune or the Chicago Sun-Times. These outlets may, if you're lucky, have a reporter who tends to cover environmental issues. But often they don't, and the trick is to kind of figure out what's the angle that might appeal to a wider audience beyond people who are maybe they are environmental advocates already, and so, you know, they care about climate change. But how do we make it relevant to your everyday person who just wants information to help them get through the day? That's really key.
Yeah. So like you were talking, is this there an AI angle or a political angle or a business impact or cultural having to do with indigenous folks who live in the area or things like that?
Yeah. And even, you know, less and less, I find that you need an angle because the truth is that the climate crisis is more and more becoming a daily reality for people. I mean, I imagine especially for you and your community in Reading. Of course, wildfires are a huge, huge threat and concern. And even here, all the way in Chicago, you know, just a few weeks ago, we had an unbelievable amount of wildfire smoke. I think our air quality indicator was in the 700s, which is unbelievable. I've never seen anything like it. And there's, you know, there's stories like that all across the Midwest. You know, when you look at 1,000-year floods that are hitting the same community, you know, three times in 5 years, any of these kind of massive storms that are very unusual. I think it's becoming less and less of a need to find an angle and more just a way to explain how we see fossil fuels and other climate policies impacting these weather patterns.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Bending the Arc and my conversation with Timna Axel of Earth Justice, a senior public affairs and communication specialist. So these journalists, how do you keep in touch with them in between stories?
You know, like you would keep in touch with any professional contact, I guess. Sometimes I might send out a note to a reporter just to check in, see what they're working on. get a feel for their workload so I can understand, you know, you know, journalists are juggling a lot. It's another profession that's really under unprecedented attack in a lot of ways. We're seeing a huge carving out of the media and institutions that support the free media. And so journalists are asked to bear a lot right now. And I think part of what I can do is just try and understand that a little bit and work with it. Instead of making their jobs harder, think about how I can make their jobs easier. How do I give them information that will be relevant to their reporting? You know, sometimes here at Earth Justice, we might be able to develop maps. For example, a map that shows all the polluters in a community that doesn't have very strong protections. Or maybe we've developed a one-pager that explains the intricacies of NEPA and how it applies to, you know, this specific waterway. And then we can share those resources with journalists so that they have one more tool at their disposal for when they are ready to pick up the pen and write something about this.
When you were talking about connecting with journalists and also meeting with lawyers in the work that you do to understand communities, you know, in both cases, you said to find out what people want or what they want to do, what is their goal. And it, you know, in my non-lawyer, non-Earth Justice mind, you know, I'm thinking that that takes a lot of engagement, a lot of deep understanding, and also a willingness to share ideas about strategies, but willingness to go with what your client or that community feels is best given the context. Does that kind of hit the mark? And what is that like, navigating a conversation where, you know, maybe in a case that you've seen something very similar before, but a community is saying, no, this is what we want. This is what will get us forward.
Yeah, I think you put your finger on a pretty present challenge. In these spaces, I think I have to recognize that I'm entering conversations with very long histories. I'm often, you know, I'm new to a space, but there's complicated relationships there that I don't fully understand. There's a lot of multi-layered advocacy. Some of it's taking place behind the scenes. I kind of have to be okay with just starting in a more observational mode, knowing that I don't know everything. And I think just allowing for relationships and for trust to develop over time before I can really fully understand what is the most useful role that I play here. And it can be frustrating, like you said. At this point, I've been doing communications advocacy work for almost my entire career here. And I've seen a lot of the same issues play out. And I often want to jump up and down and say, you're doing it the wrong way. I know the right way. But I think what helps me is remembering that the clients I'm working with are actually the folks who are the most impacted. They are the ones who stand to lose more than anyone if we're not successful. And so ultimately, they are the ones who know what the right approach to take is. And I can give my input and my guidance, but nobody has more to lose than they do. And I have to respect the decisions they make. And if it's not the one I would have made, you know, often that doesn't end up being a decider. These communities are dealing often with systemic discrimination, environmental racism, issues that span generations. And they are sometimes thinking in a longer time scale than I am. And that's something that I'm learning as I go. I think especially representing a really well-resourced, you know, and largely white organization When I'm working with fence line communities or tribes, there's just a necessary period when I need to prove myself reliable. And there's no rushing that process. I have a colleague who often says, we have to move at the speed of trust. Mm-hmm. And I think that's true.
And that, yeah, trust building can take a lot of time and a lot of vulnerability. And a lot of different kinds of engagement, depending on the space. How often do you find yourself needing to build trust by engaging outside of those specific meetings?
It's definitely helpful when I can make time and space to go beyond the Zoom meeting. Mm-hmm. Even if it's just traveling to a community, we work with some amazing community organizations in the Detroit area and in Flint. And I've been lucky to be able to travel there and meet with those folks a few times. And it just makes such a difference just to have the person-to-person connection and develop a relationship that's really based in being humans together and not just screens and emails. In some cases, I think I have been able to go further and make more of real, develop more of a real friendship that goes beyond just the work. And those have been very, very rewarding relationships where we're able to text or get on the phone and just talk. And, it can be a little tricky because everyone deserves and needs a healthy boundary between, I think, work life and the rest of life. But sometimes it really does help us work even better together when we have that extra relationship.
Mm-hmm. The environmental lawyer that I spoke to, before you was also talking about how context specific any of the solutions are to, in particular, he's talking about biodiversity work and policy, creation, that those solutions have to be, culturally appropriate and take into account all of the dynamics. I really appreciate what you're saying about the long arc of history that has led to this point and how some communities and cultures are thinking much farther down the line than some of us might in terms of wins. It calls to mind some of the work in review of early international development efforts where, people come in on their horses and have all these solutions without knowing what works there, what has been tried, what the weather or contour is like. Those things are really critical.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
In terms of communication, earlier you mentioned the Action Center. And, I'm thinking in particular, we have the Shasta Environmental Alliance here that we interviewed on mindfulness and some other groups. And there's a lot of talk about as 501c3s that have, more restricted ability. Well, you can advocate, as we spoke about earlier, for policies or legislation, but have to be very careful about being partisan when it comes to people. And there's a lot of talk on this level about what is effective for your average community member to do. Do emails to legislators count? Do you need to call? Do you have to write your own letter by hand? I mean, there's all kinds of discussion about what people have heard is effective, go beyond the larger efforts, advocacy efforts, for example, going to the Capitol and whatnot. What have you learned about what seems to move legislators when it comes to hearing from their constituents about issues?
I think you're going to get a bit of a cynical response from me.
You go.
When it comes to legislators, I think what moves them is big donors who often can skip the line when it comes to getting the ear of these legislators. You know, they have their cell numbers. They don't have to go through their DC office. Mm-hmm. But the question for us as people who maybe aren't big donors is, how do we get to those big donors? Who do we know in our networks who might have relationships, who might have relationships with those big donors? What are the news channels that the legislator tends to watch? And how do we know that? Maybe if we go to their social media page, for example, we'll see that they tend to post a lot of stories from the same news outlet. That gives us an indication that they perhaps feel that they get a favorable storytelling from that news outlet. And so maybe that's the outlet we need to really target with some of our stories and our messaging. Maybe it's the news channel we target with our ads that speak directly to the legislator. There's all sorts of strategies like that that I think allow you to get creative, because I do think there are opportunities for individuals and members of the public to make a difference by writing in or calling, but I tend to think that other ways get you there faster. And if we put our heads together, I think we can have a bigger impact.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love that. And I love the thinking creatively. I think I remember correctly from a book, Blueprint for a Revolution, and the author talking about different nonviolent, very public, small protests that one may not see necessarily as being connected to this bigger effort, but makes people question, well, why is this an issue, or why can't we such and such? And this definitely seems like a moment for some of those more creative responses.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I've seen small community organizations do, you know, small protests, creative protests. We worked with a group in Wisconsin that helped in trying to oppose this big oil pipeline in the Great Lakes, the Line 5 oil pipeline. And they embarked on an amazing campaign to try and break the record for folded origami fish. That was the goal. And they exceeded that goal by quite a lot. They created this absolutely stunning display of different colored origami fish that had been sent in from people all over the country. And, you know, a display of origami fish is not going to make a articulate, you know, policy argument to a legislator, but it may move somebody to think a little bit more deeply than they did when you mm-hmm. see, you know, thousands of pieces of paper that have been touched by folks across race and gender and age and zip code, who all care about protecting something precious like the Great Lakes. I do think it makes a difference. It makes the community stronger. It strengthens the bonds between people who are fighting for the right thing. And sometimes you get unexpected results. There was at the time, you know, a pretty, I think, unknown a candidate who showed up to one of those events. And now she's a leading gubernatorial candidate. So you just don't know what kind of people you may impact and touch, even with small creative campaigns like that.
Mm-hmm. Well, that makes a lot of sense to me. We've been talking here, too, about the power of art, both engaging people in creative pursuits, but art as a way of speaking to people without lecturing, without telling, you know, being didactic or trying to get to persuade people how to think, but to feel. And there's something about that visibility, like the AIDS quilt, to have explained that as an idea beforehand may not have seemed as powerful as it was. Traveling and having those on display. And I can think of a lot of other museums that really have shared powerful message. I think about the Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C. And I saw this when 27 years ago, and a room with shoes that were left behind, and how powerful that tangible piece that in all three of those cases that people have touched can be.
Mm. Yeah. I think that having art and having material reminders of each other and also of our collective goal is a very, very powerful organizer. And what's cool about those kinds of efforts is that they don't rely on a judge and they don't rely on a brief and they don't even, you know, rely on the election results to last. Those kinds of stories and memories and feelings can last for generations. And that's really the kind of sustained storytelling and collective advocacy that we really need, I think, to get us through this period of total chaos. Mm-hmm. And so I'm always thrilled to work with partners who are engaged in that kind of work. And I welcome it.
Mm. Do you think of yourself as a storyteller?
Yeah, of a sort, I would say so. I think storytelling is a major component of what I do. And the second major component is a goal. It has to be storytelling with an advocacy goal. Mm-hmm. for me to do my job well.
Mm-hmm. There's so much right now that could bring one despair or distress, right? And you and others at Earth Justice are on some of the front lines of trying to hold back really devastating moves, whether it's legislation or business deals. What do you find the most challenging about your role in making forward movement?
It's challenging to be confronted, I think, on a daily basis with the failures of our policies as a society and, you know, our own inadequacy as an organization and as people to stop some of the damage that's being done right now. It's really challenging to talk with people whose families have gone through unbelievable hardship. Maybe they have a huge incidence of unusual cancers in their family because they live in a community that's just been overburdened with way too many polluters and with way too little protection for a very long time. And to do that day in and day out is not easy. It can get me down, you know, and I can sometimes enter a headspace of pessimism and cynicism and, you know, feeling like, you know, hey, we're not doing a whole lot. I wish we were doing more. That's really challenging. And I think it demands some discipline to get through those moments and come through to the other side.
Mm-hmm. What, because this is an issue for all social justice organizations and people who are working for social justice. We know how long some of these struggles are and how they cycle back, like when we're talking about voting rights now, you know, and you hear all these communities saying like, hey, we fought for that with blood and a lot of effort a long time ago, and here we are again, right? So what helps you come back to the work when it's been distressing, and what, if anything, is giving you hope in the work that you have before you right now?
Well, first, I'm a big believer in boundaries and rest. and finding joy. And I take breaks when I can, and I encourage others to as well. I think, you know, we have to be able to go outside and feel the wind and the sun on our face before we can come back into our caves and do this work that's hard. And we have to give our colleagues and our partners and our clients the space to be able to do that too. So respecting those boundaries is super important. I tend to find that sometimes reading stories about other people who face these kinds of challenges in other periods, you know, you were talking about voting rights being one of these kind of cyclical issues. I'm reading a book right now. I think it's called Wilmington's Lie, and it's about the 1898 coup that happened in Wilmington, North Carolina, where the black office holders were chased out of office by a white mob that essentially just had this state-sanctioned orgy of violence, really, and a lot of killing in Wilmington. Just a chapter of history that I never knew anything about. And the purpose of it, of course, was to make sure that black folks didn't vote and didn't go register to vote, and that there would be no black people with power, no black elected officials. That is an absolutely astonishing story, not just that it happened and that it's been swept under the rug, but that we've come so far since then. And that, you know, folks in these communities have been able to be so resilient and not just give up and continue to fight and continue to win real and important victories, to the extent where that kind of a story can be kind of, I hope, confined to the dustbins of history. And so I think sometimes reading some of these other chapters of history is inspiring for me. And, you know, in general, I just feel that being engaged on a daily basis with this kind of work, even though it can be very depressing, it's also it's a practice of hope, and it's a practice of optimism, because there's always something that you can do. There's always some little thing that we can do to try and make things better. Maybe it's not the ultimate win that we were hoping for, but I think we can make this a little bit less bad for some of the people if we do this specific strategy. It's never game over. In my experience. And that's a very deeply encouraging thing. And, you know, every once in a while, we get a real win. And we just had a massive win, our team, in this case, trying to stop a very dangerous oil tunnel project in the Great Lakes, part of this Line 5 pipeline. The Michigan Supreme Court agreed with our arguments. And so for now, the company can't move forward with this tunnel. And that is just a tremendous vote of confidence and a real nugget of hope for us as we continue to prosecute this case.
That's a great example. You know, there's an institute that's done some work here, the Harwood Institute, and the language they use is starting with little ripples. You know, it reflects a lot of what you're saying in terms of what does the community want? Who can come together for those things? And what are the small changes that lead to confidence, like you mentioned, and also some momentum and the ability to have people together to take on bigger things? I mean, even the history of voting rights, didn't happen in a weekend. I mean, it was a lot of work for a really long time by individuals and communities and lawyers and everyone working together to make the change that we saw. I really liked what you said about reading other stories of how people did that. Heather Cox Richardson talked about Fannie Lou Hamer, which is very interesting. History and all that she endured and said, and I figured if she could continue under those conditions, I can continue with the privileges that I have.
Yeah, it's really is very humbling and inspiring to see people who just absolutely refuse to give up, no matter how hard things get, even though they are personally quite burdened by a lot of these problems that for many of us are purely theoretical. They refuse to give up. And I feel like I can't in good conscience, you know, put down my sword while they're still fighting.
Some of our small grassroots groups here, environmental and otherwise, many of them are all volunteer, right? And few of them can afford someone with your expertise. What suggestions would you give to small organizations that can't have someone focused on communication to educate, get the word out, kind of engage people in the issues they're fighting for?
Yeah, I would say you really don't have to hire a communication specialist or strategist if you can't afford to, but you do have to engage in the work of communications advocacy if you want to affect change. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of ways to do that. You know, look for trainings on good public speaking. Reach out to reporters, local reporters, and see if they'll just grab a coffee with you so you can get to know each other and they can hear about what kind of work you're doing. Invest in social media, you know, really understand the platforms so you can and read about them, because they have very specific uses. And sometimes they can be a huge waste of time. You know, it's important to take these communications opportunities really seriously and not just dismiss them. And I would just try and take it seriously. If you're a leader of an organization, your ability to do the storytelling and to make people understand what is the problem and how are you trying to solve it is absolutely key. Otherwise, I just don't think we can get that far.
Mm-hmm. Well, Tima, this has been so helpful. I can't wait to share this with a lot of our organizations. But before we go, is there anything I should have asked you that I didn't, or anything else that you want to say as we close our conversation?
I guess I would just say, you know, if folks are looking for a way to get plugged in and get involved, you can certainly get involved with Earth Justice. Go to our website, earthjustice.org. But it doesn't have to be us. There's so many amazing, incredible organizations out there doing good work. I would just encourage folks to research them, get connected with them, make a small donation or a big one. But do something. It'll feel good and it really will help.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to Bending the Arc on KKR, and check out our archives. You can listen to this show again and get contact information for some of the things that Tina mentioned. And I can't get low. I cannot stay. And I cannot go. Can't say yes. And I can't say no. I can't hold on. No, I can't let go. No, I can't let go. Thank you for listening to Bending the Arc on KKRN. Our theme music is provided by Jacob Akana. I can't let go. Remind me, please. Who am I, though? I don't believe I can't let go. No, I can't let go. No, I can't let go.